the rise of domestic violent extremism is a serious and growing national security threat.
White supremacy is the biggest bucket of concern when it comes to domestic terrorism.
I think this is a big enough threat, an attack on the center of our democracy, that it's going to need a look that spans branches of government, something closer to a 9/11 commission.
The Biden administration will confront this threat with the necessary resources and resolve.
The leaders of the Democratic Party have now decided that 74 million Trump voters weren't just wrong or misguided. They didn't simply back the wrong guy or have incorrect opinions or fail to see the obvious truths. No, the threat they pose is graver and more serious than that, more dangerous. These 74 million Trump voters are, in fact, terrorists. They're a looming physical threat to the rest of us, and we must deal with them in the way that you deal with threats like that, existential threats to the nation. Saddam Hussein, al-Baghdadi, Kim Jong-un, Donald Trump's voters. For years, they told us this country had been infiltrated by Russian spies, but now we know it's worse than that. Just today, the Daily Beast, the homepage of our highly credentialed but not super bright ruling class, ran a piece with this title: Can U.S. Spy Agency Stop White Terror? Other countries, the story pointed out, have domestic spy agencies to fight extremists at home. So, of course, we need one right away. What the piece does not mention is that those other countries would include China, North Korea, Kazakhstan. Domestic spy agency is a not very subtle euphemism for secret police. That is what they're calling for.
The members of the Biden team who have been nominated or have been appointed are now moving in laser-like fashion to try to uncover as much as they can about what looks very similar to insurgency movements that we've seen overseas, mm-hmm. where they germinate in different parts of a country and they gain strength, and it brings together an unholy alliance frequently of religious extremists, authoritarians, fascists, bigots, racists, nativists, even libertarians.
We don't have to guess about where this goes or how this ends when you have people like former CIA Director John Brennan openly talking about how he's spoken with or heard from appointees and nominees in the Biden administration who are already starting to look across our country for these types of movements similar to the insurgencies they've seen overseas that, in his words, he says, make up this unholy alliance of religious extremists, racists, bigots. He lists a few others and adds at the end, even libertarians.
Democrats in Congress support a new secret police agency, but why wouldn't they support it? What better way to protect your own power than funding a, quote, domestic spy agency to fight extremists at home? Those extremists, needless to say, will be their political opponents. So you don't have to worry about them anymore because they'll be in jail. Just last year, Congressman Brad Schneider of Illinois sponsored legislation to begin the process of creating just such an agency, empowering current agencies to spy on Americans based on their political beliefs. And guess what? Schneider's bill sailed out of the House Judiciary Committee. All but two Republicans voted for it.
I heard a declaration of war against white supremacy and against the lies that brought our democracy to the brink. And President-elect Biden will inherit an unprecedented domestic security crisis.
A declaration of war against white supremacy. Now, you may not have noticed that because on one level, it's not very remarkable. Not many Americans support white supremacy. Most people in this country find it disgusting, of course, and they should. But the question is, what is it exactly? Now that we're waging war on white supremacists, can somebody tell us in very clear language what a white supremacist is?
What characteristics are we looking for as we're building this profile of a potential extremist? What are we talking about? Religious extremists? Are we talking about Christians, evangelical Christians? What is a religious extremist? Is it somebody who's pro-life? I mean, where do you take this? You start looking at, okay, well, obviously you have to be a white person. Obviously, likely male, libertarians. Well, if anybody who loves freedom, liberty, maybe has an American flag outside their house, or people who, you know, attended a Trump rally. Once you start walking this down the path, you see where it leads to a very dangerous undermining of our civil liberties, mm-hmm. our freedoms in our Constitution, and a targeting of almost half of the country.
I would make sure that we, in fact, focus on how to deal with the rise of white supremacy.
If confirmed, I will supervise the prosecution of white supremacists and others.
I know thousands of people. I go all over the nation. I don't know any white supremacists. I don't know. Maybe they're in the basement. You know, there's vile stuff on the internet. Yes, the Proud Boys, a few hundred of them. The FBI is all over them, and they should be. Proud Boys aren't doing this country any good. But Antifa, Black Lives Matter, global organization, way more destructive.
So again, what is a white supremacist? You might be surprised to learn just how broad the definition for that has become. Bloomberg News has described a wall along our southern border as, quote, a monument to white supremacy. So be certain not to support that. Colin Kaepernick, who seems to have the unequivocal support of corporate America, calls the 4th of July an example of white supremacy. So you'd better put away the fireworks and the hot dogs. The United States Army, a trusted institution if there ever was one, has used an entire manual on what is and what is not white supremacy. So you should know this. Among the telltale signs of a committed white supremacist are these: celebrating Columbus Day, using the term American exceptionalism, any support for federal border security or English-only measures, or, quote, education funding from property taxes, all white supremacy. Using the phrase, there's only one human race, is white supremacy too, according to the Army. And of course, voting for Donald Trump, all white supremacy.
From Russian collusion, you go through all of the lies that the left and the Democrats and a lot of Republicans, too, have said over the past 5 years in an effort to damage Donald Trump, sabotage him. But look, it's really alarming what the Justice Department is doing. And for Merrick Garland today to repeatedly say that he is going to put yet another political partisan prosecution at the top of his priority list, overtaking the serious public safety concerns that most Americans have. A lot of his comments today were very alarming. This is another use of our Justice Department weaponized against political foes of the Beltway, but now they're targeting average Americans, holding them without bail in jail and bankrupting people for misdemeanors.
A rise of political extremism, white supremacy, domestic terrorism, that we must confront and we will defeat.
We will defeat political extremists, domestic terrorists, white supremacists. Those are America's enemies. We must wage war against them. We must, quote, defeat those people.
We are demonizing a class of people, a 75 million Americans, if not more.
The thing that struck me so much about that John Brennan video is, it would be one thing if they were saying, look, there's a band of people, 20 here, 50 over here, who wear swastika armbands, who still are in the KKK. There's maybe 2,000. We need to... That's not what they're saying. What he's saying is the exact opposite. Every group he lifted, even libertarians, it's essentially he's defining the insurgency as anyone who has an ideology other than neoliberalism. In other words, other than the ruling class view that is about to congeal and merge with the power of the state.
We are in a scary time. American freedoms are being obliterated under the name of politics, under the guise of installing equality, and they're stripping us of our American freedoms.
And what they're talking about explicitly, Tucker, is using the tools that they used to take ISIS off the internet, the tools that they used to destroy Al-Qaeda. They're talking about it as a second war on terror. And that first war on terror, no matter what your views were originally at the beginning of 9/11, ended up eroding not civil liberties just elsewhere, but here at home as well. One that is born by name of being a domestic war on terror designed to essentially criminalize any oppositional ideology to the ruling class. There is literally nothing that could be more dangerous, and it's not fear-mongering or alarmism to say it. There are bills pending by Adam Schiff as well that would simply take the existing war on terror legislation, always aimed at foreign governments and foreign actors, and simply simply amend it to say we can now do that within the United States?
Thankfully, Sandy Cortez has been thinking about this for quite some time. Indeed, since she was a child growing up in leafy Westchester County. Some little girls played with dolls, but Sandy Cortez put her Barbies in a secure enclosure and re-educated them because they were thinking bad things, forbidden things. So Sandy Cortez knows exactly what to do now.
We had a program addressing white supremacists that we had programs, federal programs, that went towards funding organizations like these that de-radicalized people. And President Trump pulled the plug on federal funding for some of these programs. And so one thing that we know is that we have to get that funding right back up, and we probably need to double, triple, quadruple, or increase funding for these de-radicalization programs.
The totalitarian instinct is always the same, always. Only the names of the dictators change. First, you strip people of their right to speak out loud, honestly. Then you prevent them from defending themselves and their families. And then, because you now can, you force them at gunpoint to read your catechism, to accept your orthodoxy. You wonder if Sandy Cortez plans to make Trump voters sign written statements affirming they have been deprogrammed. Of course, that's always part of the process.
One of my dear friends is a slightly older mentor of mine who is the daughter of Holocaust survivors. And she kept saying to me, and I'm Jewish, so I don't take this lightly at all, my grandparents lost relatives in the Holocaust. She kept saying to me as we were reading news events, they did this in Germany, they did this in Germany. And I thought she was insane, you know, or at least hyperbolic. And she kept saying, they did this in Germany, they did this in Germany. And she's not talking about the horrific nightmare outcomes of, you know, 1938, 1939. She was talking about the early years when Germany was still a working parliamentary democracy, fragile, besieged on all sides, but a working parliamentary democracy with newspapers and human rights lawyers and Bauhaus and fashion and celebrities and a lot of the things we would find recognizable today. And she insisted that I sit down and start reading history of the early years, the years when everyone was looking around thinking, surely this is going to pass. We won't stand for this. Surely it can't get worse than this. And the more I started reading, first the history of the early years, the pressure on this fragile democracy, and the stripping of that constitution and the closing down of those civil liberties. And then when I started reading the other great tyrants and how Mussolini kind of pioneered the closing down of a fragile democracy in the 20s, and then Hitler studied Mussolini, and then I looked at the 30s in Germany, and then Stalin studied Hitler, and Hitler studied Stalin, and I looked at Stalin in the end of the 30s, and then I looked at East Germany in the 50s, and Czechoslovakia in 1968, Pinochet's coup in Chile in 1973, the Chinese crackdown on the democracy movement at the end of the 80s, early 90s. What became clear is that would-be despots on the left or the right, no matter where they are in the world, always take the same 10 key steps. They always do the same 10 things. Systematically, it's like a blueprint for closing down a democracy. And the early tyrants, the great tyrants, kind of developed it, this technology. And then petty tyrants, tyrants all over Latin America, for instance. We're looking at what's happening in Myanmar right now, Pakistan. They all kind of study it and know what to do to close down democracy or crush a pro-democracy uprising. So it was very disturbing to me that as I read these histories, it was clear that we're seeing the same 10 steps in America today. It's this myth that we're walking around in, which the founders have been horrified at, that democracy will always protect us and that what closes down open societies overseas could never happen here. I think I'm pretty specific, identifying exactly what the steps are and what the dangers are and what the real tipping point actions are. I mean, I think it was a tipping point when the United States Congress agreed to let the state essentially torture people in its control. That was one of those tipping points that if you follow closing societies, you recognize you never want to give the state that power, because I invite you, you're so scholarly. You're so well educated. I invite you to name, and nobody's been able to do this yet because there isn't one as far as I know, a society that created a network of secret prisons where torture takes place, where the state did not eventually end up turning some of those tactics of abuse on domestic. I think what we are all in America is a state of kind of reptile brain tunnel vision that makes it very, very difficult for us to take a sane, wide view the way other modern democracies are doing. Let me give you an example. In England, Gordon Brown has said, fighting terror. Terror is a crime, not a cause. And they have sustained horrific terrorist attacks for years, the same bad guys that we're fighting. And they are not using that as an excuse to crack down on civil liberties. Let's look at Spain. Spain also experienced a horrible, horrible terror attack, same bad guys. And they are trying those accused in a transparent process, using that trial to uphold and showcase democracy. You can see the transcripts on the internet. So, yeah, I think all of us, the courts, Congress, and the executive, have to kind of snap out of this nightmare and look at history and uphold democratic principles. The fourth step, that create a surveillance apparatus aimed at ordinary citizens. We have that now. The Washington Post just reported that, you know, when you get on a plane now, they're keeping track of what you're reading on the plane and who's sitting next to you and who you're going to go visit and what their phone number is. In East Germany, a majority of the citizens weren't being watched by the Stasi. Only a minority were. But all it took was knowing that the Stasi were watching you to subdue a whole population. You know, the fifth step is to infiltrate and harass citizen groups, and the ACLU has many lawsuits underway that's happening. So that key part of democracy, being able to gather with your neighbors and say, you know, I'm not happy about the war, I am happy about the war. You know, now there are agents among us watching what we say and what we do. The sixth step is to arbitrarily detain and release citizens. This gets really disturbing because, and again, it's a classic fascist tactic, and I use fascist quite conservatively. I use it according to the dictionary definition of when the state starts to use force against an individual in an effort to close down democratic processes, and we're seeing that. You can't say we're not seeing that if the president can hold you or me in a cell in solitary confinement for months or years. The state has that power now. But I was on the TSA watch list. So that every time I got on a plane, I would get this quadruple S security clearance, a security warning on my ticket. And finally, I asked this nice young woman who was searching me, you know, why does this keep happening? And she said, you're on the list. And I said, the list? And then, and you know, I don't think I fit a terrorist profile. The next step is to target key individuals. And, you know, this was a very effective tactic that both Mussolini and the National Socialists developed of, for example, Goebbels purged the equivalent of PBS and NPR when he got into power, and then they put pressure on academics in Italy and in Germany at state institutions to coordinate, was the term, with National Socialist ideology, or else they lost their jobs. So people started, key figures in society, and they were usually sort of visible performers, entertainers, editors and journalists, academics, and opposition leaders began to find that they would face first smears, then job reprisals or job loss if they didn't support the regime in question, then increasingly criminal sanctions. They would get caught up in ever-proliferating laws that criminalized speech, for example, and so more and more kinds of speech became criminalized. And finally, they were just rounded up and arrested, which is what would-be despots, as you know, always do. I mean, we're waiting for the shoe to drop in Myanmar for those brave, brave monks to be rounded up and arrested. I mean, the extraordinary courage that they have. You know, we have to ask ourselves, do we have that courage? Because it's time for us to be taken to the streets now, while we're still relatively safe and not later. I just talked, someone came up to me after a reading yesterday who works in government, and he said, you know that we have to sign this kind of loyalty oath now. And I said, what? And he said, yeah, there's this, they're basically building a dossier on everyone, and it's like the identity card in Germany. I either sign it and let them go through my banking records and check my credit report and find out everything they need to find out about me, or else I don't have a job and I lose my house. also target key individuals. There was this drumbeat of, well, charge him with the Espionage Act. And again, journalists in Washington, when they publish classified material, there are talking points where people say, charge him under the Espionage Act. Very scary, because as you know, but most Americans don't know, the last time the 1917 Espionage Act was used was, in fact, to round up people like, I keep wanting to say you and me, but certainly people like me, activists, people who were, you know, fighting against child labor exploitation, socialists, teachers, anti-war critics, journalists, editors, Americans, American citizens, rounding them up without warrants, right? Putting them in prison where some of them were beaten. So that's not a happy sign, the invoking of the 1917 Espionage Act. Eugene Debs got a 10-year sentence under the Espionage Act for giving a speech about the Constitution. And the use of the Espionage Act at the end of the teens silenced dissent in America for a decade. The last thing that you start to see, we're starting to see now, which is the recasting of criticism as espionage and dissent as treason. It is such a classic warning sign of a closing society when the state starts to censure speech and starts to target organizations of dissidents for state censure. I really want to stress that what I'm looking at when I look at Germany isn't Nazi outcomes. It's not, I'm not saying we're going to have crematoria or we're going to have, you know, a regime, you know, that's so far from what I'm saying. What I'm saying is much more considered and very right, which is that there are certain tactics that have been developed and are time-tested in closing down a modern constitutional democracy. And there are two places where this happened, in Italy and Germany, that we can learn from. And we're seeing, if you look at 1931, 1932, the beginning of 1933, you'll see things recur, and we owe it to the victims of that Holocaust to learn the lessons of history. And why do I think it's so urgent? Here's why. It's a very good question. What most people think is that democracy is strong, and so if there's a closing down, that it goes like this, like a diagonal line on a chart, and that we've got time to stabilize and react. That's not how it works. History shows that democracies close down in a series of what Malcolm Gladwell would call tipping points, and that when certain things start to happen, when certain tipping points have been reached, things start to close down very fast. So there was one such tipping point when we legalized torture, and we don't have to revisit that. We did legalize torture. The second tipping point was when we gave the president the right to say that he can call any of us an enemy combatant. If you look at Stalin and if you look at Hitler, and what they did was that they began to expand and expand the definition of terrorist, and we're seeing that with the rephrasing of sort of animal liberation attacks against property as terrorism, those expanded sentences. But you also start to see more and more people and activities being called treason, traitorous, terrorism, sabotage, espionage. And the final step is to subvert the rule of law, and or to make it easier to declare martial law. And again, activists all over the world know what a foolish mistake it is to pass something like the 2007 Defense Authorization Act that gives the president, it makes it easier for him to declare martial law. You know that in a closing society, it's a classic tactic. You purge the civil service of independent thinkers. You focus especially on lawyers and judges. That's what Goebbels did. And then you don't need a coup, because in a close election, if that had happened, it would be the end of America, essentially. It would be over. Because in a close election, the U.S. attorneys are the ones who have the power to go after, investigate voting rights groups, and who have the power to really... In a closing society, you will still have elections. You just won't have free elections. You won't have uncorrupted elections.
More than two centuries after freedom of speech was enshrined in the First Amendment, that right is very much in the news. Campus speech codes, disinvited commencement speakers, deplatformed professors, jailed performance artists, exiled leakers, a blogger condemned to 1,000 lashes by one of our closest allies, and the massacre of a dozen French cartoonists have forced the democratic world to examine the roots of its commitment to free speech. Is free speech merely a symbolic talisman like a national flag or motto? Is it just one of many values that we trade off against each other? Was Pope Francis right when he said that, quote, you cannot make fun of the faith of others? May universities muzzle some students to protect the sensibilities of others? Did the Charlie Hebdo cartoonists, quote, cross a line that separates free speech from toxic talk, as the dean of a school of journalism opined at the time? Or is free speech fundamental, a right which, if not absolute, should be abrogated only in carefully circumscribed cases? The answer I will argue this evening is that free speech is indeed fundamental, and it's important to remind ourselves why and to have the reasons at our fingertips when that right is called into question. There's a danger that freedom of speech will become a term of boilerplate, a box to be ticked, an element in a long list of things that people value without being able to explain why. That could even feed a more pernicious development, free speech becoming an identity badge of the political right. In my book, Enlightenment Now, I reviewed the literature on human rationality and discovered that the principal cause of stupidity in the political realm is not, as many scientists suspect, scientific or historical illiteracy, but politicization. As soon as an issue becomes branded as a sacred cause of the political left or the political right, intelligent people shut down their critical faculties. They accept arguments and evidence or blow them off, depending only on which tribe they appear to vindicate. They even lose their ability to do arithmetic. If through intellectual laziness we allow free speech to become associated in people's minds with the political right, just because some of the notorious challenges involve left-wing groups suppressing non-left-wing speakers, then it's game over for free speech on college campuses and much of the mainstream media. In talking about free speech, or anything else, we're talking. We're not settling our disagreement by a beauty contest, or an auction, or a pistol duel. Unless you're willing to discredit yourself by declaring, in the words of the great free speech advocate Nat Hentoff, free speech for me but not for thee, then as soon as you show up to a debate to argue against free speech, you've lost it. Second, free speech is the only way to acquire knowledge about the world. Perhaps the greatest discovery in human history, one that is logically prior to every other discovery, is that all of our traditional sources of belief are generators of delusion and should be dismissed as sources of knowledge. These include faith, revelation, dogma, authority, charisma, augury, prophecy, intuition, clairvoyance, conventional wisdom, and the warm glow of subjective certainty. How then can we know? None of us is omniscient, none of us is infallible. Other than by proving mathematical and logical theorems, which are not about the material world, the answer is the process that Karl Popper called conjecture and refutation. We come up with ideas about the nature of reality, and we test them against that reality, allowing the world to falsify the mistaken ones. The conjecture part of this formula, of course, presupposes the exercise of free speech. We offer conjectures without any prior assurance that they're correct. It is only by brooding ideas and seeing which ones withstand attempts to refute them that we acquire knowledge. The most pressing historical question of the 20th century is how monstrous totalitarian regimes, particularly those of Stalin, Hitler, Mao, and Imperial Japan, came into existence. There are a number of conjectures, such as the popular libertarian hypothesis that societies with extensive social welfare systems and copious government regulation are likely to slide down a slippery slope into totalitarianism. It's an interesting hypothesis with a major flaw, namely that nothing of that sort has ever happened. Instead, fascist and communist regimes come to power through violent intimidation. In every case, groups of armed fanatics used violence to silence or intimidate their critics and adversaries. Even the apparently democratic election of the Nazis in 1933 was preceded by years of intimidation, murder, and violent mayhem against dissenters. And once in power, totalitarians criminalize any criticism of the regime. There's a systematic reason why dictators brook no dissent. One could imagine a regime that is armed to the teeth, can resist any insurrection, and allows its subjects to impotently bitch and moan all they want. But that's not how totalitarian societies work, and for a good reason. The immiserated subjects of a tyrannical regime are not, of course, deluded that they are happy. And if tens of millions of disaffected citizens act together, no regime has the brute force to resist them. The reason that citizens don't resist their overlords en masse is that they lack what logicians call common knowledge in the technical sense, namely the knowledge that everyone else shares their knowledge. Common knowledge is a prerequisite to coordinating behavior for mutual benefit. Two friends will show up at the same cafe at a given time only if each knows that the other knows that both know about the appointment. In the case of civil resistance, people will expose themselves to the risk of reprisal from a despotic regime only if they know that others are exposing themselves to that risk at the same time. In computer simulations of artificial societies, the sociologist Michael Macy has shown that open channels of communication are essential in preventing unpopular beliefs, those that no one believes but that no one dare deny, from becoming entrenched. If true believers can punish skeptics, then a minority view can take over. But if skeptics can sample the beliefs of their compatriots, the collective delusions can unravel. Common knowledge is created by public information, such as a broadcasted statement. The story of the emperor's new clothes illustrates the logic. When the little boy shouted that the emperor was naked, he wasn't telling anyone anything that they didn't already know, anything they couldn't see with their own eyeballs. But he was changing the state of their knowledge nonetheless, because now everyone knew that everyone else knew that everyone else knew that everyone else knew the emperor was naked. And that common knowledge emboldened them to challenge the emperor's authority with their laughter. The story reminds us why humor is no laughing matter, why satire and ridicule, even when puerile and tasteless, are terrifying to autocrats and protected by democracies. Satire can stealthily challenge assumptions that are second nature to an audience by forcing them to see that those assumptions lead to consequences that everyone recognizes are absurd. That's why humor so often serves as an accelerant to social progress. 18th century wise guys like Voltaire, Swift, and Samuel Johnson ridiculed the wars, oppressions, and cruel practices of their day. In the 1960s, comedians and artists portrayed racists as thick-witted Neanderthals and Vietnam hawks and nuclear cold warriors as amoral psychopaths. The Soviet Union and its satellites also had a rich underground current of satire, as in the common definition of the two Cold War ideologies, quote, capitalism is the exploitation of man by man, communism is the exact opposite. We use barbed speech to undermine not just political dictators, but the petty oppressors of everyday life, the tyrannical boss, the sanctimonious preacher, the blowhard at the bar, the neighborhood enforcer of stifling norms. Now, it may seem outlandish to link American campus freedom, which by historical and global standards is still admirably high, to the world's brutal regimes. But the connection is not totally far-fetched. Last year, I addressed the Oslo Freedom Forum, a kind of TED for political dissidents. I met people who escaped from North Korea by walking across the Gobi Desert in winter, people who were jailed for a single tweet, people whose families were thrown in prison because of their own political activity. These stories put the relatively minor restrictions on campus speech in perspective. But the American commitment to unfettered speech, unrivaled even by our democratic allies in Europe, stands as a beacon of inspiration to the world's dissidents, one of the few features of the American brand that still commands global admiration.